from KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our galaxy contains far more habitable Earth-like planets than previously thought. That's according to a UC Berkeley-led analysis. The study, which appeared on Monday in the proceedings of the National Academy of Science, finds that about one in five of the sun-like stars in the Milky Way may have planets approximately the size of the Earth, capable of holding liquid water and bathed in sunlight. I want to discuss those findings, which are pretty exciting and fascinating in this Forum segment and are based on observations by the NASA Kepler Space Telescope and look at some other perhaps stellar and planetary matters. And one that's particularly been highlighted in the news and almost made front page, which we'll begin with. But first, I want to introduce you to the two astronomers who are here with us. Andrew Fracknoy, of course, is chair of the astronomy program at Foothill College, well known to Forum listeners, and delighted to have you here as always.
Nice to be back with you, Mike.
And Eric Pettigura is with us as well, a graduate student at the University of California, Berkeley. He studied astronomy and led the analysis of the Kepler data, along with people like Jeff Macy and professor over at the University of Hawaii. Good to have you, Eric. Welcome to the program.
It's great to be here.
And let me actually begin with you and find out, because this is pretty exciting stuff, as I said. I want to find out a little bit from Andy about the space launch up to Mars by India. But the Kepler's thing, you've compared to the study that you did to being like a pole, and that's P-O-L-L, pole.
Oh, yes, that's exactly right. So, of course, to do a census of planets in the galaxy, or to use the analogy of a poll, to predict who's going to win the presidential election, of course, you don't go out and count, call every single person. You try to find a representative sample, and that's exactly what the idea behind the Kepler mission is. We took a representative sample of stars, we counted planets, and then based on the fraction of the galaxy we surveyed, we come up with a total number of planets. And of course, with any poll, there are biases and corrections. For example, if you wanted to figure out who was going to win the presidential election, you wouldn't just call people in Berkeley, California. That would be a biased sample. So we worked very carefully to understand the biases in our survey and to correct for them.
And what you concluded is that there are maybe approximately 20% of sun-like stars having planets the size of Earth and actually orbiting it with temperatures capable of having water, compatible with water?
That's exactly right.
And again, some of this was done by, well, not only acting like a pollster, and we don't want to get it confused with Gallup here or anything, but, I mean, actually sort of filtering out those planets that didn't quite fit into the picture.
Oh, well, so like any poll, you need to define your sample well. And we chose to look at stars that were like the sun. So they're known as G and K stars to astronomers. So these are stars as big or slightly bigger than the sun and stars that are slightly cooler and less massive than the sun, down to, about 0.7 times the mass of the sun.
And these are in what's called the habitable zone or the Goldilocks area. Can you explain those to us?
Sure. So the habitable zone is the range of orbits where liquid water could plausibly exist on the surface. Now, in our own solar system, Venus and Mars are in the habitable zone. And, of course, we know that they don't have water on them right now. But Mars, we're pretty sure, had liquid water in the past. And there's less compelling evidence that Venus did as well. So I'd like to make an important distinction that just because a planet is in the habitable zone doesn't mean that it's inhabited.
That's an important distinction. But Andy Fracknoy, this increases the likelihood in many people's minds of life being out there. Maybe there being another Earth out there or something just like an Earth 2.
Right. Earth 2.0 is what we've been talking about. This is, for me, the dream announcement that science fiction fans have been waiting for years. The first time that we've actually been able to get a statistical estimate, a reasonable poll of what's out there in terms of planets. And this is a very conservative poll, I would say. They've only looked at stars that resemble the sun.
You're not talking about red dwarfs here.
Yeah, although it turns out that because of this excellent work with Kepler and other telescopes, we are now finding planets even around stars that are not sun-like, hugging their stars, so maybe still okay for places to live. But overall, just the sheer volume of Earth-like planets is astounding, and that opens up the galaxy for further exploration with a great deal of optimism.
Makes us feel so common, too, right?
Well, common, or because we don't know if any of those places actually have intelligent life, it may well be that these are places that are like Earth used to be, or they're places where civilization has destroyed itself because it can't get its act together. And just understanding the sheer variety of places is going to take centuries, if not millennia.
We don't know what's rocky, and we don't really know. Although I know there's some MIT studies of this, you might want to talk about that, finding out what these planets are made of.
That's right. So from the measurements of this satellite called Kepler, we can only measure how big the planet is.
Which, excuse me, is not operating anymore. Right?
Well, it's not operating anymore, but they still have a year's worth of data we haven't analyzed. So for us, there's still Kepler results in the future. But what we can learn from Kepler is how big the planet is. There's another method of finding planets that the Berkeley group pioneered, which I like to call the wiggle method, where we know the existence of a planet from the way it makes the motion of the star wiggle a little bit as the planet goes around. The wiggle method tells us how much gravity or how much mass there is in the planet. If you could know both, if you could know how big the planet is and you could know how much it weighs, that would tell you whether it's made of rock or made of gas and liquid like Jupiter. And just recently, we did have an announcement of a rather weird Earth-like planet, which was rocky. And so we've measured both those characteristics for this particular Kepler planet. And there are rocky Earths out there, we now know.
And could you just say something about this launch to Mars from India? It's become kind of headline news here.
Well, this is an interesting idea. This is a relatively modest satellite. The name of it is Mangalayaan, which means Mars craft in the Indian language. It's designed to orbit Mars, test out the whole idea of just getting there, which is new for India, and then make measurements of the atmosphere, of particular components of Mars's thin atmosphere. It's an attempt on the part of India to become part of the club of interplanetary explorers. We've had the United States, the European Union, we've had Russia explore other planets. India wants to join that club. And I think it's not up to us to say what country should or shouldn't join this club, a club of whose activities we approve. This is not like nuclear weapons.
I was going to say, not like the nuclear club, yeah. Much better than that. Eric, let me go back to you, Eric Pettigrew, and congratulations, by the way, on this data that you've published. It's quite something. And I know an immense amount of work went into it, but you've even got some planets out there that Earth-sized planets going around in orbit like 8.5 hours time.
Oh, well, yeah. So you're referring actually to the Kepler 78 planet, which was actually published by one of my co-authors on my paper, Andrew Howard, who's at the University of Hawaii. And
thank you for his name. I'd forgotten it. Yeah.
So the Kepler 78, which is an Earth-sized planet, we measure the size of Kepler, and because the orbit is so short, 8.5 hours, the wiggle method, as Andy was describing, is strong enough to produce a detectable wiggle on its host star, which is measurable by telescopes on the Earth. Now, I might add that a huge amount of telescope time went into this project, and because the habitable zone planets that we're finding are so far away from their star compared to this Kepler 78 magma planet, it's really impossible, at least in the near term, to measure their masses and get a density, although we'd really like to be able to do that.
And Andy Franklin, was there a star found back in June with six or seven planets where there might have been, again, water, and it was a lot like our solar system?
That's right. So the interesting thing is we've been finding a whole variety of planets. You heard about the magma planet or lava planet. It's so close to its star that its surface is probably molten. We found super Earths. We found planets that are bigger than the Earth but still rocky, which is something we don't have, really like twice or three times the size of the Earth. We don't have that in our solar system. We found mini Neptunes. We found Neptunes. We found Saturns. We found Jupiters. Just the variety of planets out there is staggering. And this is a whole field of astronomy that began about 20 years ago. And in the last 20 years, we've gone from zero planets known outside the solar system to 1,000 planets confirmed. And the Kepler mission just announced that they had over 3,000 more candidates that they needed years and years of graduate student study before they could fully understand.
Well, I've seen different figures. Figure of 8,000 Earth-like planets. But in the galaxy, we may have 11 billion, or if you include red dwarfs, 40 billion, something
right.
along those
lines. So the difference is what planets have we actually already gotten to know, and then there's this statistical estimate of how many might be out there based on the few that we've gotten to know, extrapolating to the whole galaxy. So given that where the Kepler telescope is looking is a reasonably typical part of the galaxy and making reasonable assumptions, we now know that billions of stars like the sun are likely to have planets. Some of them way at the other edge of the galaxy, some of them nearby. They estimated that on to the statistical estimate level, the nearest planet like this might be only 12 light years away. But for astronomers, that's spitting distance. That's nothing.
Only
12 light years away.
So is this going to get more money for SETI, for search for extraterrestrial intelligence?
I think what we are going to find is that this is the new way that we will target the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Once the team at Berkeley so kindly finds planets for the SETI astronomers, people like Jill Tarter and others working with SETI are now going to point their telescopes to the specific planets they found and use them as the first kinds of targets for search.
And what do you see happening as a result of all this, Eric? Or what do you want to happen?
Just to touch on SETI, so we know where these planets are. And moreover, we know that the planes of the planet's orbits, if the planet happens to transit in front of its host star, the plane of the orbit is actually pointed at Earth. And if you think about all of the radio transmissions, the most powerful radio transmissions that we're doing in our own solar system, they're concentrated in the plane of the solar system, things like the Arecibo planetary radar. In fact, from the perspective of SETI searches, looking at planets that transit is actually a really good idea.
Well, let me bring our listeners into this. I'm sorry, this gets me jazzed. This is exciting stuff. We're talking about the search for habitable planets, and our galaxy contains far more Earth-like habitable planets than was previously thought. We have Eric Pettigura with us, graduate student at UC Berkeley, who studied astronomy and led the analysis of the Kepler data. And Andrew Fracknell here in studio is chair of the astronomy program at Foothill College, and you can join us. In fact, we welcome your involvement in the program. If you have questions or comments, now is the time. Our toll-free number is available to you. 866-733-6786 is the number to call, and again, we welcome your calls. We can talk about matters astronomical in general, but talking particularly about the search for habitable planets, and to a lesser extent, perhaps the India launch, which is big, too. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or join us by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And actually, a listener out there wants to know, when we see a planet that looks similar to ours, how do we reach out? And you're talking about only a few light years away, but Andy.
That's right. So it's really important to make that point, which you're implying, which is that the fastest spaceship we have today, if it were going in the direction of the nearest other star, would take something like 80,000 years to get there. It's very hard to find graduate students to volunteer for that trip.
Eric, are you game?
No.
So it's not likely that we're going to travel to the stars. But what Eric is talking about and what you've been talking about with SETI is that instead of going there, we do with the stars what you do with your listeners, Michael. You don't visit everybody's home. What happens is that your show is transmitted at the speed of light using radio waves to everybody's car and everybody's home receiver. And we're hoping to do the same thing with the aliens. If they're out there, they may be sending out, either on purpose or accidentally, radio waves or other kinds of waves, which we can overhear, which we can intercept, and we might be able to know that they're there by their transmissions rather than by visiting.
I keep thinking about Frank Drake and all those equations about what number of likely intelligent civilizations may be out there. This increases the possibility.
Absolutely. Frank is very excited. He's been interviewed as a result of this work, and I see him regularly on the SETI board, and he's really very jazzed by these discoveries that the Berkeley Group and others have made about planets. This increases the chances of life, which is what the Drake equation is all about.
And then again, kudos to Eric Pettigura, Jeff Macy, and Andrew Howard of the University of Hawaii. Berkeley's got the two up on this three here, but it's really all three and a lot of work, really the kind of hard work is Eric's as well. Let's get your calls on, and Keith from Palo Alto is first up. Hi, Keith.
Oh, wow. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. You've been talking about planets that might have, be able to harbor life, but I'm curious about what percentage of the planets would be the right size that humans could actually survive on.
Well, so when you say humans survive, of course, we can survive on a planet like Mars, even though we can't breathe the atmosphere. So this gets back to the question that Michael asked a few minutes ago, which I really didn't answer. Right now, we're just beginning to learn about these planets. We see them as dim little points in the distance. But there is a group of studies, including the one at MIT, where we are trying to learn what the atmospheres of some of these worlds are like, mostly for the giant worlds. There's a technique where we can get the light of the star and the planet together. Then we get the light of just the star when the planet is behind the star, and we subtract the two.
That's just what MIT is doing.
Yeah, and that's where we get just the light of the planet. And so it's an amazing study, and we're starting to learn what particular gases are in the atmospheres. This is just being done for giant planets right now. But someday, with better telescopes, with probes in space, we may be able to learn not just how big these worlds are, but actually what kind of gases around them. And then we might be able to answer your question about whether a human could live there without a spacesuit, or we'd need a domed base like we would on Mars.
Well, here's a related question from Bill, who emails us and says, there has been speculation that life might exist in the oceans below the ice crust of Europa, one of Jupiter's moons. So what about all the new planets being discovered or counted? Could their moons be habitable even if their planets aren't?
I think
sure.
That's...
So,
go ahead, Eric.
So I think we need to keep an open mind when it comes to the question of habitability. Mars may have been habitable in the past, and Europa, as you mentioned, might be habitable now. And, of course, Europa orbits at a distance from the sun that's actually larger than the habitable zone that we used for our study. So, in fact, the possibility of life in exotic environments is something we should keep in mind.
Okay, and let me bring in some more calls. Andy, you want to
add something? I just want to add that in the movie Avatar, the scene takes place on the moon of a giant planet orbiting the nearest star system. So the science fiction writers are already there with the idea that it could be a moon around a giant planet out there that harbors life rather than just a planet.
All right, I want to get to more callers, but since you mentioned the movie Avatar, what about the movie Gravity?
Oh, well, so Gravity is a wonderful movie with lots of great effects. I love, for example, without giving anything away, you can see the tears coming off Sandra Bullock's face, and very correctly, they form round tears, just like we found in space. The big problem with it is that the basic premise isn't right. You can't just shoot yourself over from the orbit of the Hubble to the orbit of the space station. They're at widely different orbits. But they said when they were interviewed that they made that leap of faith on purpose to give a plot to the movie. So if you discount that, there are many wonderfully scientifically correct things.
In the literary world, this is what we call the dene. You accept the given, you suspend your disbelief, and then you go with the rest of the
story.
All right. Here's another caller. Ed, you're on. Good morning. Welcome.
Hi, Mike and guests. From my physics education, I think the basic form of life exists within the structure of the atoms. Give atoms enough time, enough condition, and they will make life. The problem is, I like to put a damper in your whole theory, is we haven't heard anything from anybody. And the fact is, the sun is much newer as a solar system than many other solar systems that preceded us by billions of years. We have not heard any signal. And you have this Voyager with only 10-watt transmitter, is still transmitting from far away in the solar system, yet KGO or KQED have 50,000-watt transmitter. Other planets, 100 light years from here should have been heard something from beginning of Marconi on, we haven't heard anything. That brings me the Fermi paradox. It seemed life, or technical life at least, is so rare. And even if it happens, it takes place, it either destroys itself or get destroyed by gamma ray burst or by asteroid or by something. I'd like to hear your guest idea about that.
Well, the silence is deafening. I think he's right about that.
Well, I think that's true, but you have to remember that we've been listening a very short time on the cosmic time scale. The Earth has been around 4.6 billion years, and we've been listening for like 50 years. So Jill Tarter, who's the leader of the search, likes to say that the amount of listening that we've done so far, given all the stars out there and all the different ways they could be sending messages, is like dipping one test tube into the ocean, a single test tube into the ocean, looking at the test tube saying, oh, there's no fish, therefore there are no fish in the ocean. We really haven't had the time or the equipment or the patience to explore the wide range of messages that might be out there. So it's way too early to say that the silence is proof of anything.
Well, here's a question, Eric, for you. But go ahead. I think you want to add something, Eric?
Yeah, so I think the caller is touching on an important aspect of these results, which is if you take the prevalence of planets, you multiply it by the number of stars in the galaxy, you get 10 billion or tens of billions of planets in the galaxy. And there's only two interpretations from that. Either the galaxy is teeming with life, or life is exceptionally rare.
Well, here's a question about the studies. David writes, since these studies began, I've often wondered about discernibility of orbiting planets around remote stars. To the extent the solar plane within which are local planets is a general phenomenon, it follows geometrically that remote stars with solar planes containing the line of sight from here have a higher likelihood of presenting a stellar intercept than those not so aligned. Example, by definition, planets orbiting a remote star in the plane normally never traverse the star from the perspective of our line of sight. Were these factors taken into account in this latest Goldilocks estimate? It's a good question.
Of course they were. So planets, it's a very particular alignment of planet and star so that you actually see the planet crossing the face of the star. And just to put some numbers on the table, for the Earth transiting the sun, crossing in front of the face of the sun, only 1 in 200 observers can detect such a transit. There's a 1 in 200 probability of seeing the Earth. But because we looked at so many stars, we can take that into account. And so even though the probability of seeing an individual planet transiting in front of its host star is small, we looked at so many stars that we can begin to see them, and then, of course, correct for that geometrical alignment probability.
And we go to Bob. Bob, you're on. Good morning.
Oh, hi. I had a question about the assumptions about the necessity of water for life. And it seems to me that at the scale of the galaxy or the universe, there's possibilities for all sorts of chemistries of life that don't necessarily require water. And so I'm wondering if this, where does this assumption come from that life requires water? I mean, clearly it's necessary for it in this instance, but it seems like there's a very large possibility of different chemistries of life that don't require water. And I'm wondering if you could just comment on that.
Yeah, I'm glad he brought that up because I'm looking at an email here. And Andy, you and I have had this discussion. You know, we always talk about life as we know it, but there could be life as we don't know it or never imagine. This, just to dovetail with that, this other listener writes, it's simplistic to think that life could only exist in the universe within parameters similar to Earth. If the one criteria for life is a creation of complex chemistry, one only has to look at Titan to see chemical creation in a system completely different from our own. Life could be very different than we could possibly imagine. And I would add, without water.
That's the moon of Saturn's called Titan, much colder than we are, has a completely different chemistry where there's liquids, gas, and ice, but it's not water. It's actually methane on this moon of Saturn's. But this leads to the more general question, and I think the Berkeley team has very well explained this. When you're starting out in science, you start out with the simplest thing. You start out with the thing we know best, and then you proceed toward the unknown. When we were looking for planets, we began with Earth-like planets around sun-like stars, because that's what we know best. That's not to say that's the only place we're going to look. They're already looking at stars much, much dimmer than the sun, much fainter in their light output. They're looking at all kinds of different stars, and we're looking for all kinds of planets. Same will be true with life. We begin with life as we know it, because guess what? We know it. And that's a big advantage. But eventually, we are going to proceed to other environments. We're not discarding any planet as a possibility for life. We're just starting with the known and moving slowly toward the unknown.
And we're discussing the findings based on observations by NASA's Kepler Space Telescope. Andrew Fracknoy is chair of the astronomy program at Foothill College. Eric Pettigura is part of the team that published these findings in the Proceedings for the National Academy of Science. He's a graduate student at UC Berkeley. Mark writes, the entire discussion is moot in the face of the impact of carbon output climate change on our own planet. Our planet will be inhabitable for humans very soon. Please put your fantastic minds to work solving this problem, or everything you're discussing is a pipe dream. Whoa. Okay.
I can take a stab at this. So, you know, we mentioned the Drake equation earlier in the show. It's basically trying to parameterize all of the things, all of the requirements for, you know, calculating the number of intelligent civilizations in the galaxy. And the last term in that equation is the expected lifetime of a civilization. So you make a very good point, which is if intelligent civilizations snuff themselves out either by climate change or by, you know, global nuclear war, that sort of thing, the number of intelligent civilizations in the galaxy is very small.
And I want to bring on another caller. That's you, Lorna. Good morning. You're on Forum.
Good morning, and congratulations. You finally have done it. It's a program that's out of this world. I think that's great.
You mean the other ones have not been? There's never been another one that's out of this world?
Well, I just had a couple of comments, and again, I wanted to thank you for bringing this up. But over and over we hear, this is impossible to do because, you know, it would take 80,000 years to do it. And I remembered Michio Kaku, whom I'm sure you all know, had once taken a piece of paper when somebody proposed that. He said, you know, we always think that they're going to use our technology. And he took a piece of paper, he put a dot one place, put a dot in another. He said, we're here, they're there. He folded the paper, stuck a pencil through it, and he said, if they've discovered a wormhole or some other avenue, they're here in a nanosecond. And as an artist, I keep remembering all of my life is all about inspiration. And one day I thought, what if it's not inspiration? What if it's instruction coming to us from highly advanced races that maybe are doing an experiment here as well? And then I said one day, what about the DNA? We just discovered the DNA, the human genome. What if that DNA has encoding in it that has been put there by highly advanced races?
So, you got to be writing science fiction. That's that's your calling, I think. And thanks for calling us. This brings the hour to an end, but it's been a fascinating half hour to an end. Thank you so much, Andy Fracknoy. Thank you, Eric Pettigura, and good luck with the ongoing processing of this data. Stay tuned for Forum. We're going to have a conversation with Kermit Lynch, famous winemaker and wine writer, in the hour up ahead. Forum's produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and executive producer, Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.